Welcome to the Newsbusters podcast with the executive editor of Newsbusters, your host, Tim Graham.
Hello and welcome. I'm here in the studio with my boy Ben, and I feel today like taking a page from that old Don Geronimo and Mike O'Mara radio show. They used to say, we're fat, we're white, we're Catholic, and we're sick about it. We are not as sick as Michael Avenatti, who was sentenced to 2.5 years in the Juzgado yesterday. It's so bad, even Geraldo is calling him disgraced. But this just sort of underlines the media's modus operandi in the Trump years. We've talked about how Donald Trump's approach to the media is sort of, you like me, I think you're good. I like you, you like me, that's good. You hate me, I hate you. This is actually also the news media's judgment in the Trump years. If you hated Trump, you were better. If you had the power to take down Trump, you were a hero. Just the idea of him talking about taking down Trump made them delighted. You could almost compare Avenatti to Alec Baldwin, who would say that liberals would come up to him and, you know, thank him for his Trump impression on Saturday Night Live, like that was somehow saving the world. Or at least it was emotionally getting me through the trauma. Avenatti was their spirit animal or something. Or I suppose you can't say spirit animal now. That has become an objectionable term. What should be objectionable was all the gush over Avenatti, in particular, Anna Navarro on The View, who compared him to the Holy Spirit. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of Michael Avenatti. Come on! Oh, that's just terrible. The other clip that they like showing on Fox is Brian Stelter touting him as presidential timber because of all of his TV appearances. Well, the media was the wind beneath his wings. They puffed him up until he was as high as Icarus. And when he melted and fell, they didn't really want to notice. We pointed out last night when we looked at this, a Newsbuster study in 2019 compiled by Bill D'Agostino found the liberal media hoisted up Avenatti with 254 combined TV appearances, mostly in the first half of 2018. CNN was the sleaze leader with 122, and MSNBC was not far behind with 108. I mean, I remember days where I think Avenatti literally had 7 interview segments on these cable networks. He was also appearing on the regular broadcast networks. ABC led with 12, CBS had 7, NBC had 5. So then you ask yourself, well, didn't he do a Fox News interview? Actually, he did 2. One of them was with Tucker, which most people remember because it was quite a face-off. There was no, as far as I can tell, no PBS NewsHour interview for Avenatti and no NPR interview for Avenatti. Some could say that that shows you that the public broadcasters have some sense of class. It's also true that PBS and NPR never got an interview with President Trump, or candidate Trump, for that matter. There are just some things where, this is part of their branding. That doesn't mean they didn't do all sorts of sleaze on these networks about, you know, Brett Kavanaugh's accusers. And we'll remember that Michael Avenatti was pushing Julie Swetnick, who is about as credible as the other Kavanaugh accusers. So last night, Curtis Hauck and Nick Night Train Fondacare were on it. CBS and NBC had nothing on Avenatti last night, and ABC put on a little brief. PBS did too. PBS had 41 words on the NewsHour. I couldn't find anything on NPR, but I will say on NPR.org, they don't post the half-hour newscasts. They just list the segments on All Things Considered. There were no Avenatti Things Considered last night in their segments, and nothing in the segments of Morning Edition on Friday. MSNBC had nothing. I mean, literally nothing. So I looked at Nexus over the last 6 months of MSNBC transcripts, and they don't have everything in there. Like, they don't have Morning Joe in there, but I think they have pretty much prime time, probably back to 4 or 5 p.m. But MSNBC had nothing. And over the last 6 months, there was one mention of Avenatti. Some guest, like, threw his name in on Ari Melber's show. In those 6 months, you still do get 33 results for Stormy Daniels, just not for her lawyer. There was a, literally on Thursday night, a Lawrence O'Donnell mention of Stormy Daniels. Was he was telling Eric Holder, the Republicans have no shame. Trump taught them to have no shame. And he mentioned Stormy Daniels, but he doesn't mention Avenatti. So Lawrence O'Donnell also has no shame. Oh, by the way, when you go into Nexus for MSNBC over the last 6 months, you put in Tara Reid, you get zero. Stormy Daniels still gets 33 in the last 6 months. Avenatti was quite the star. David Rutz, then of the Washington Free Beacon, calculated that by May 11, 2018, CNN and MSNBC alone had given Avenatti a grand total of $175 million in earned media. You may put your pinky to your lips. More than $1 million. $175 million. That did not include the more than $500,000 he and Stormy earned from their now-defunct Crowd Justice page, like a Kickstarter account for lawsuits. That's something he plugged relentlessly during his early 2018 television appearances. You know, he milked it. He got all of the fame. He got all of the money. And now Stormy is suing him, saying that he took Stormy's money. That's not a part of the 2.5 years he just got. There's more stuff coming on in court to make Avenatti's life miserable. So it came up again this morning. We were amused on CBS this morning where they had tried to sort of do a brief chat about Avenatti going to jail. And Jamie Wax, who we've rarely heard of, said something that didn't go over well. He suggested maybe we went about covering him the wrong way. Co-host Tony DeCoppel said, "I wouldn't say we." He repeated, "I wouldn't say we." And Wax says, "The press, collectively, like not CBS, just we." And DeCoppel says, "It's a big tent." Well, excuse me, we can quickly find CBS This Morning co-host Gail King, who sits right next to Tony DeCoppel, called Avenatti a rock star. So you might want to put away the "I wouldn't say we" defense. The latest column is about critical race theory. CNN is very upset that anyone would suggest that the white children are being taught garbage. You can't say that. You can't panic the white parents. And she turned to an educator in Philadelphia named Keziah Ridgway, a black high school teacher in a hijab. Well, I put her into Google. And it's like, what are we going to find from Keziah Ridgway? What we found was an article in Education Week where she boasted about being what she called an abolitionist teacher. She wrote, quote, "I teach African-American history using a curriculum that has abolished the white supremacist, racist, and patriarchal lenses that are intrinsic within schools and are so harmful to all students." She explained her label of abolitionist teaching as if slavery still exists. Abolitionist teaching is, quote, "steeped in community organizing and informed by critical race theory, the understanding that race is a social construct used by white people for their own political and financial gain." There it is. The grand conspiracy theory. The white people are all conspiring. We're all in on it. It's a big, huge scandal. We're all saying to each other, let's maintain the social construct of race for our own financial gain. Keziah continues, quote, abolitionist teachers call out racism and discrimination both within the school and larger society. They teach from a place of love that centers black resistance and black joy. So that's the objective for students of all races, is that they're taught with a curriculum that centers on black resistance. And then somehow this is not racist, it's anti-racist. Or as usual, it's affirmative discrimination and compensatory racism. You'll now get yours. Keziah insisted that school leaders needed to, quote, meet with black, indigenous, and other educators of color. She didn't say BIPOC, but that's basically what she's saying. They should meet and listen to their experiences as both students and teachers. From that, faculty should create new courses and syllabi representing the best of abolitionist teacher preparation. Keziah went on CNN, and what she told the reporter was, we are not teaching critical race theory in schools. Yeah, you are. You quite obviously are. You're boasting about how you do it. You're boasting about how it should be required. School leaders need to meet with the BIPOC and get in line. You can be for critical race theory. You can be against critical race theory. What reporters really can't do at this point, if they want to be honest, is somehow try to suggest critical race theory isn't in our schools because it's there. It might not be in every school, but it is the hot trend. So if you want to love this trend, go ahead and love this trend, but don't deny that this trend exists. We'll have more after this.
MRC-store.com.
Pro-gun, pro-life, pro-God, and pro-America? Welcome to the Pro Shop.
MRC-store.com.
T-shirts, hoodies, goodies, and much more.
MRC-store.com.
The only store that always offers conservatives more.
That's MRC-store.com.
Log on, log in, and help the Media Research Center while shopping for great gear today.
MRC-store.com.
So, a video circulated on Twitter yesterday from the Bongino Report and some other accounts. It's a video of White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki ginning up a sing-along of Happy Birthday to Reuters White House reporter Steve Holland.
I did hear it was Steve Holland's 29th birthday. So, happy 29th birthday. I'm a terrible singer, but I am willing to lead a song here if you are all game.
Is this a good day to ask for an interview with the president?
It may be. Who's with me? Someone here has a good voice. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Steve. Happy birthday to you. All right. I will also note, Brian Karam, excellent voice. I don't know what you do with that, but that's one thing I learned today.
I had a few thoughts on this video on Twitter. Number one, Jen Psaki kissing up to a reporter on his birthday is just good politics. I believe Jen Psaki even tried to say nice things to Peter Doocy when he returned from his honeymoon. It shouldn't be surprising when a press secretary tries to be nice to a reporter, at least at the start of things, before the questioning begins. Number two, Jen is right. She is not a good singer. She was smart to try to gin somebody else up to being the song leader on Happy Birthday. And number three, the test of a press corps isn't really this kind of social moment. It's the questions that follow after the friendly opener. But there's no doubt in this video that the press does a lot of giggling, that they sound very friendly, like, hey, 99% of these people voted for Jen Psaki's boss. I will say this, though. I spent 2 years in the White House press corps way back in 2001 and 2002. And the White House press secretary back then was Ari Fleischer. And there was a difference when, Ari Fleischer was doing what they call the gaggle in the morning where there's no cameras on. And what the gaggle usually was here's what's going on today. Here's where the president's going to be, or here's where what the president's going to talk about. And reporters generally would ask these sorts of questions, what's going on today? And it was kind of palsy, and people would talk to Ari Fleischer about his Miami Dolphins, or he would talk about his Miami Dolphins. It was kind of friendly like this. And then came 1 o'clock when the briefing was on, it just had a totally different sound to it. It was much more formal. So, I mean, I think that the press corps does operate in a big group, and sometimes they're going to be, you're going to have social moments. I mean, and as the press secretary of whichever party, yeah, you want to sort of get these cats into a herd and try to be friendly to them. One of the things that you do as a press secretary, outside of the briefing, is you're trying to theoretically help every reporter get their story together about what's going on from the White House. Well, the White House beat really is, there's not a lot of scoops that come out of the White House. I mean, most of what you're doing is repeating what the president said or repeating what the press secretary said, or sometimes what some other administration official said. Sometimes those administration officials would come into the briefing room and take questions, and you might use clips of that. One of the things I really learned quickly when I was in the White House was these networks and newspapers aren't really competing viciously with each other. At that time, Terry Moran of ABC and David Greger of NBC would be palling around, and they looked like they were going out to lunch. You have to understand, when you see this footage of them all singing happy birthday to Steve Holland, a lot of these people actually work in the building. They have little tiny offices in the basement of the West Wing. It is their office. It's not like they go down the street to the New York Times Washington Bureau or to NBC News, which is way up on Nebraska Avenue. They literally work inside the White House together. So their coworkers, the ones that they have a cup of coffee with and chat with, are their fellow White House reporters. And so that's one of the reasons, if you're singing happy birthday to somebody, it's just like if we have a birthday in our office and somebody brings the cupcakes, it's a little like that. So I don't think of that in particular as an indictment of the White House press corps. These people also, when they're not in the basement together, they're flying around on a jet with the president together. They spend a lot more time with each other than they do with people who are actually their workmates at Reuters or the networks. So, I think you need to judge them by the kind of questions that they give to Jen Psaki, and not just from the singing at the beginning. We did notice yesterday the president took some tough questions about Afghanistan. This is apparently a subject where the press has all decided that, gee, we have questions to ask about withdrawing from Afghanistan. And they were fairly skeptical with him, and that always stuns you a little. And then, of course, you always have to ask yourself the next question, which is, even when they do somewhat tough questions with the president, and you can see those live on cable, but how do they make that through the system, through the newspaper articles, through the television newscasts? All of that is part of the process. The other thing I wanted to mention, since we're talking about reporters in Washington, Vice News, the people who used to gurgle over Obama, they had an interview with him for HBO in 2015. They have an article up about Capitol Hill reporters that are still traumatized by the horrible Capitol riot on January 6th. That was a scary day, no doubt, especially if that's your daily workplace. You can understand that while it was going on, that was a scary thing for reporters. And especially because these are people who are very mad that Donald Trump didn't win in a landslide. Reporters are going to feel like they could be targeted, just the same way that we could sympathize with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being scared of the rioters. That makes complete sense. It's sad, but it makes sense. It's too bad that this whole thing happened. So a freelancer named Matt Laszlo was quoted in this Vice piece. I recognize the name from reporting he did for the local NPR station here, WAMU. This was kind of one of the quotes that went around. Laszlo said, "It's my office, the building I love most in the effing world. I used to call the Capitol my girlfriend." That's unusual. "I've devoted 15 years of my GD life to that building," he said. Choking up, they said on Vice. "Now, instead of being there every day, I'm there once a month. I don't want to be there." As somebody who's reported from the White House, I think if terrorists had hit the White House on 9/11, I might have felt like this. This would be a terrible thing. But there wasn't a jet that went into the Capitol, you know. And I do remember... I was a reporter on 9/11, and there was very much a concern that the terrorists or the jets were going to target the White House. And then I could just imagine if I was actually at the White House trying to report things, and they're like, "Excuse me, there seems to be a jet headed here." You can understand where reporters would be just as afraid as anybody else. PBS reporter Lisa Desjardins told Vice she's become an insomniac of sorts. She also suggested that the parties are more bitterly divided over it. She made it sound like mom and dad had had a bad fight. This is where you have to remember that reporters at the White House or reporters in Congress are probably there for 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 years. They are insiders. They are not outsiders. So angry outsiders make insiders nervous. It's also apparent that liberal reporters have lost any collegial feeling about the Republicans who objected to Biden's certification in any way. There's a quote in this Vice article from John Bresnahan, who was with Politico for a long time, and now he's with this punch bowl site that some of the Politico people made. He said, "That was the thing that surprised me most the entire day. They'd just gone through this in the House, and they were still effing objecting." 121 House Republicans voted for objections to certify the results from Arizona, and 138 against certifying Pennsylvania. So he thought there should be zero votes. And some of the Republicans did peel off after the rioting. Bloomberg News reporter Eric Wasson told Vice, "It could definitely happen again. It's something that's on my radar. We've become very complacent in thinking the U.S. is different. It's eerily back to normal, but sometimes it feels like one of those horror movies, like the end of Jaws. Everything feels copacetic on the beach, but you wonder if there's anything out there." There's no doubt that you can go through this and worry it's going to happen again, especially when you're hearing this chatter from people making these strange proclamations that Trump's going to be president again on August 13. And, oh, by the way, according to some wackadoo that was featured on Twitter, Trump's coming back with JFK Jr. I don't know how they're raising JFK Jr. from the dead. But when you hear this kind of chatter, you can see where you might be nervous that this is going to happen again. On the other hand, we have just gotten through 6 months without there being another riot. I mean, we've had more violence against Capitol Police, which they really didn't want to talk about, than they really don't want to remember. But we haven't had more violence at the, you know, that would threaten the reporters or the members of Congress. And thank God for that. The Washington Post has a story today on reporters being subjected to violence. Media reporter Paul Farhi, I'm going to get into this today, but I did read through it and discover this entire piece never mentions Antifa. How do you do a story on violence against reporters and not at least somewhere in your 20 paragraphs or whatever mention Antifa? It's the same thing that we've talked about before, that Antifa can beat an NBC reporter and NBC doesn't talk about it. Or Antifa can throw bottles at the heads of CNN reporters and the CNN reporter goes on reliable sources and says, I can understand their anger. If you're going to be upset about violence against reporters, it ought to be from any direction. But this story in the Post seems to suggest that somehow all violence and threats against reporters is Trump's doing. That's very misleading. So hopefully we'll do something on that. So come to Newsbusters once, twice, 24 times a day. Thanks for checking in.